Dr. Steve, here with us this Monday. Dr. Steve Salzman, how are you?
Hey, how are you? Happy Monday.
Happy Monday. A programming note, you and I did promise we'd talk vitamins this week. We're going to move that to Friday. The vitamins you need, which ones you don't, which ones to avoid, all that stuff. Is vitamin sales huge? They've gone up enormously during the pandemic, but we're going to kind of take a deeper dive and do that Friday. Does that sound good? Is that okay with you?
Indeed, a deep dive we shall do.
I love it. I love it when you do that. All right, hey, but there are a couple of headlines here I do want to ask you about. One of them is this whole idea. There was in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend about the COVID vaccine and how some, this is the headline, COVID-19 vaccines are effective after one dose. And I wonder, we've been saying all along, you got to take both doses. What do they mean by that?
We need to take both doses. That's what they mean by that. Just so we're very clear. I thought I was very clear on Friday.
I love how you bottom line things. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, no, but listen, here's what this is about. Pfizer, they did research, and basically they showed that the vaccines provided strong one-dose protection. And one of the vaccines actually can now be stored in one of the normal freezers instead of the ultra-cold ones. And so, you know, this is all good stuff. But really, when you deep dive through it, basically, they said that the Pfizer vaccine generated robust immunity after one dose. This was new research out of Israel. And further data, by the way, showed that the University of Oxford and the AstraZeneca vaccine similarly prevented COVID-19 when doses were spaced sort of 3 months apart. Even though that's not on the market, you know, it showed that 3 months out, patients were still, you know, well protected. And Pfizer is going to go, by the way, this week, since we're talking about it, and ask these U.S. regulators to allow transport and storage of the vaccine at minus 20 degrees Celsius, sort of the standard freezing. And if they can do this, it's another sort of win because it'll vastly expand access into rural regions of the world, as well as pharmacies and doctor's offices and all these places. The research that was published in Friday in Lancet's medical journal was that one dose of Pfizer's vaccine was shown to be 85% effective in preventing symptomatic disease 15 to 28 days after being given it. The problem is they don't know how long it lasts. And this was very good. This was peer-reviewed, 9,000-person observational study that was done by the Israeli government. But there's still a lot of questions. And remember that this is all research that's being done on the fly, you know, like real time. But all of the actual data and where they came up with this two-dose regimen was from those studies. Now, what they're trying to do is sort of build enough immunity in people with one shot. If they can do that and push it off several months, you can get many more people inoculated by not having to give them the second dose, perhaps in such a short period of time, 3 weeks after the first one. But, you know, for now, this doesn't change anything. And like I told everybody, you know, whether it's the Pfizer or the Moderna, it's two shots, you know, 3 weeks apart, and everybody needs to get both.
Okay, this comes up a lot, though, and what you're saying is significant, because I know that in the UK they delayed that second dose by 12 weeks, up to 12 weeks, and to try to get the mass population vaccinated, as you point out, and now they have a third of their adult population currently with at least one shot. The federal government, if I'm not wrong, decides which of those doses are first doses and which are marked for second doses, and that's the way you have to use them. So I wonder if they'll be thinking about amending that policy here to try to get them in as many arms as possible, at least the first dose. Why would we not do that?
That's what a lot of people on the Sunday morning shows are screaming about. And it's with, you know, they have good backing to say that. The other thing is, how quick is the Johnson & Johnson one going to come to market? You know, if next Friday they approve another one and boom, within a month or two, you know, we can get another one on the market, you know, great. But you're right, Anna, that's correct. There's going to be a month, two, potentially three, before it ramps up even further. And absolutely, vaccine policy might have to shift and change as a function of we can't get it in enough people's arms. It's just a cold reality. Remember, we talked about this, Anna. We said it, right? Mm-hmm. The first phase was going to be wonderful, the honeymoon phase. But once you got into a mass inoculation of a massively large population with, you know, no sort of clear distinctions and quasi-rules, you knew this was going to get like this. This isn't surprising. Frustrating, but not surprising.
Yeah, I guess, and that's just part of it. This is all new. We're doing it in mass, you know, distribution and things that have never been done before, both in developing a vaccine this quickly and getting it out to the population. So we do have to be patient. I think it's fair to question the policy, and I know that comes up a lot. We'll see. Maybe they will make a change there. It appears the government is making a change on labeling masks, that they're either considering this or they've taken some steps already, Dr. Steve, to say, hey, not every mask is the same, or we want to make sure they reach a certain amount of standard, a certain standard. I've thought about this when I'm shopping for a mask, and I'll just wonder, is this really cheap one over here, this one that's $2.99, as good as this one over here that's $9.99, and which one should I be buying? And I just wonder, it just feels as if there isn't much of a standard out there. Do you think that's necessary to tell people?
I mean, correct. There is no standard, and I think this is actually good. This is one of the good things that come out of things. You know, I've learned so much. I haven't learned much more about necessarily science or medicine per se, Hannah, but I've learned about every society and sort of testing people. And these are the American Society for Testing and Materials. It's an international standards organization. But basically what they've done is, They've created standards for like a number of consumer products, crayons and playground equipment and baby cribs, a whole bunch of stuff. And they spent the last 7 months conducting these expedited testing and reviews. And eventually, Tuesday, they published guidelines. And this new national mask standard sort of outlines minimum fit, design, performance, and testing requirements for the face masks. And basically, it would require user instructions, package labeling, and a permanent tag on the product. And so these ASTM labeling would mean that it met this sort of testing and quality requirements outline. So it would bring everybody into some standard, you know, because there's no real standards. And again, these new standards, by the way, so we're clear, are not going to apply to medical masks or respirators that are used in healthcare settings. This is just for the general population. And the labeling requirements, by the way, are going to involve results of two testing criteria, breathability and filtration efficiency. And basically, you know, the higher the filtration, obviously the harder it's going to be to breathe through it. So I think they're going to have a level one, which is going to be 20% of particles being filtered, and a higher performance one, level two, I think, that's going to be at least 50%, but it's going to be less breathability. But they're going to try to have OSHA and the CDC and everybody sign on to it. And this is a very good idea, because you have, with all the masks that have come on and all the times we get questions, what about this test and that test? The market is massively flooded with things now. So it'll be good to have some ability for some comparison between products and someone sort of looking over it. That can't hurt.
No. Okay. I like that answer. Hey, when questions are starting to come in for Dr. Steve, 312-981-7200. He'll give you his straight answer here on GN. And also, I want to ask you just briefly when we get back, we got to pause here for a moment, about this study out about how there are seasonal differences with the spread of COVID. We've talked about this back in the beginning. Does summer make a difference from winter? There's more data out now. I want to ask you about this study, because if that's true, that it spreads faster in winter, does that mean spring and summer will provide an even greater reprieve from what we're seeing now? We'll talk about that with Dr. Steve. Answer your questions here on GN, 312-981-7200-143 this Monday afternoon. I just want to ask you about the seasonal differences.
So the only thing I've learned, Dan, is that everybody needs to join Phil and Rita down in Boca. So this is very interesting. So they analyzed daily COVID-19 versus weather data from over 3,000 administrative regions in more than 170 countries. What they found was that the spread of COVID-19 through a population tended to be lower in the weeks following higher UV exposure. And so they examined how transmission changed according to the variations in sunlight, temperature, rainfall, and humidity. And they found that the changes in UV between winter and summer led to a 7% point decrease in the COVID-19 growth rate on average across the Northern Hemisphere. But if you read this carefully, and everybody, this is why we read things carefully, the authors talk about correctly, they caution that UV exposure alone is unlikely to stop the spread of the virus without strong social distancing and, you know, of course, you know, with mask wearing. And they're not sure what mechanism is even driving the effect. So this looks great. And yes, it might be lower. but we had plenty of hot places. And when the community got going, and you know, and one person was 10, was 100, it didn't matter what the temperature was. That was a wrap, and there were hundreds of people. Lots of people sick. So, you know, nothing changes with all this. It's great to talk about all of this stuff, but very clear things have sort of helped clamp down somewhat on this. What is going to be the vaccine, and to a bigger degree as it keeps going? And, of course, all the mitigation strategies. This is what's done it. And I'm sorry, whatever questions we don't get to answer today, we'll answer on Friday. I'm sorry, go.
Sure. All right, let's get to them. Go. 708. We've talked to Dr. Steve. You've talked about having a reaction to the vaccine, that that's a good thing. That means it's working. What does it mean if you don't have a reaction to the vaccine?
It means you're just like me. It means absolutely nothing. You like to see a little something just to know, okay, I didn't get water. It was really vaccine, but it is vaccine. And you might get some reaction. You might get no reaction. Some people might have a worse second than first. Some people might have both. It doesn't matter. Just you line up and make sure you get the two shots 3 weeks apart. That's the important thing. How you feel is immaterial to the matter.
Okay. Good to know. 847, I had my first Pfizer vaccine shot last week. They scheduled my second shot 19 days later. Is that okay?
Yes, I don't think there's a absolute, you know, if you do it at day 18 or day 19, this isn't going to work as day whatever. The study, you remember, this is all done just based on how the study rolled out. And everybody got their first dose and then their booster 3 weeks apart. 19 days, 27 days, it won't matter much. And as we just spoke about before, Anna, let's be honest, right? One dose might cover you, and they might change vaccine policy as a result of some data coming in. And now that might last 3 or 4 months. But for right now, that's not the policy. We're not doing that, and you line up for the two doses.
Okay. Understood. 262, how soon after the second shot can you take Aleve? I heard over-the-counter drugs can change the effectiveness of the vaccine. Is that right?
They won't change the effectiveness of the vaccine, I don't think, but you would like to just sort of wait off. You don't want to pre-take it, that's for sure. You want your body to have the immune response, and you don't really want to try to quell it with anything. But if you have the second vaccine, for instance, and, you know, 10 hours later, 12 hours later, you feel absolutely horrible. If you took something like a Tylenol or an Advil, it's not going to inactivate the vaccine. It's not going to change much. We don't want people pre-medicating. But I think once you get the vaccine, post-medicating, if you do it, if you have to do it, it's not going to harm anything.
Okay, another comment here about, I had both shots, no reaction to either one. I think people are feeling like, okay, is my body working, and is it going to be okay? And you're saying yes, it happened to you.
Yeah, you know, that doesn't mean anything, you know, and so the next time you would have a vaccine to something else, and you might have the worst reaction ever. You know, there's no rhyme or reason potentially to it. Everybody's immune system and body are just different, chemistry and physiology. That doesn't mean anything. Don't be nervous. I was completely fine with both. And I'm not nervous in the least. You shouldn't be either.
Okay. Question about herd immunity here. This is coming up a lot, too. 708, the U.S. has had 25 million cases of COVID. It was once predicted that, let me just get through this, cases may be 5 to 10 times higher than the actual number of confirmed cases. Could we be closer to at least temporary herd immunity than we realize right now?
Ooh, somebody's a statistician and extremely clever. And the answer is, I can't prove it, but damn right, I think you're right. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, I think there's many, many more people. But remember, herd immunity, we're talking about 70, 80%. So are we there? Oh, no matter what. But have this is grossly underreported, or people that have been exposed and don't even know they've been exposed? Yes, that person's correct, and we're going to find out sort of, you know, years or two or three later when we look back at it, that number, I talked about it a few weeks ago, it could be staggeringly off, you know, that badly. But we'll see.
Okay, a couple questions about antibodies, too. 630, Hyannick, asked Dr. Steve if a blood donation will detect COVID antibodies, and how far back in time will these be detected?
So that's not how I looked this up, and I'll double check it again for Friday. They do not believe that the Red Cross is testing for that. And you could go onto their website because it's very well explained, and they answer a lot of the COVID questions. But in terms of blood and blood donation, there's no problem with it. The only thing with blood is that right after the vaccine, you might not feel good. So donating blood might, you know, might be bad. And in terms of blood donation, there's really no contraindication. But if you got a vaccine, I would just probably wait 24, 40 hours just to make sure you don't feel terrible. And in terms of antibodies, I mean, we could talk about it. What's the actual question? Is it an antibody test? In other words, for
how far back in time will they be detected? Because I was wondering that, too. I went to my doctor for my regular checkup, and they did blood work, and I said, can you throw that antibody test in there, too, just so I know? And he did, and he said, nope, I'm not going to tell you this is definitive, but you haven't had it. And he couldn't tell me how far back it went. This was about five months ago.
Yeah, I don't know that anybody knows the answer to that. Good question. Once you're exposed to it, you would think that you have at least 3 or 4 months of it would be detected, possibly even longer. But I don't really think they know that yet. You know, and of course they're going after different things right now. You know, so they focus on data until there's a new data point they need to study, and then all the efforts now going into vaccination data and stuff. So they're right. They're not free flowing of that kind of data. But yeah, I mean, I would think several months back is the answer is what I would think you'd be able to detect it for sure.
Yeah, because there's another question too. Ask them if the antibody tests have improved and are they worth it if you have to pay for it. So would you say go get one? What would you say?
Why? My question is back is with a question. Why are you getting it? Is it just like a morbid curiosity that you might have been an asymptomatic carrier? Okay, I guess that's fine. You know, the question becomes why are you getting it? And again, if it's vaccine related or you want to check things, there are so many on the market now. But I know that there are at least, I believe, a few that have been FDA approved. So you always start, when you're going to do something like that, you go big or go home. So I would go with something that's FDA approved. So it's been looked at and studied, similar to the masks you want in agency. You want somebody looking after you for things like this. Because remember, no test is 100%. And even the best test that they have, there are false positives and false negatives all the time. They are not 100%. No test is 100%. So that's why I ask, why are you getting it?
Morbid curiosity was the answer to the reason I got it. I just wanted to know. I don't know that it helped me, but I just wanted to know. Dr. Steve, this is about a vaccine priority. I work overnights at a hotel. I've worked with the public every single day in person. This entire pandemic, we're overlooked as essential workers. I managed to get a vaccine appointment. Can I take it? Are they going to tell me no? I guess they're saying they're not officially in that 1B or wherever we are right now to qualify.
I don't know the answer to that. I think if somebody's given the appointment, they won't turn them away. And that's my understanding. I don't know how each individual site works. But I agree with this person. Like you talk about people, I'm going to side with the guy and say, absolutely, I understand. Oh, my God, many people could work from home, but this guy is in the hotel industry. You have to be at the front desk. Someone's going to check in. I agree with him. He's got a lot of contact. This is very difficult. This is what we're talking about, right? Once we got into the 1B and then further down the line, this was going to be a problem. But again, some people are going to balk at it and go, he should give up his appointment because he's not in the group and we should give it to somebody who's 7-year-old. And we talk about the vaccine age, right? So there are so many different viewpoints depending on who you are and what point of view you're looking at, so people could take from all angles. I don't know what they're going to say.
Yeah, I don't know either. And I know that there are some folks that weighs. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. I'm asking you, help me on this one. What do you think the right answer is? Are we going to shame him? Say no, give it up?
No, I feel for this person because I can tell. I didn't even read the whole email, you can tell that there is. This is weighing heavy on him. That he's probably very concerned every day he goes to work with the public every single day. He doesn't have the choice to work remotely. These are tough ethical questions, right? There's some that are just sort of black and white. When those 20-somethings in Florida get dressed up like grannies to go get the vaccine, no, that's wrong. And then, the people with underlying health conditions, they deserve to be first in line. And let's make a way for them. This is tough. This is tough. And you just wish there'd be more supply. Hey, before I let you go, I don't know if you had any ice problems around your house, Dr. Steve, but I just got a text from a listener who says people on the lake by the planetarium yesterday. There are a whole bunch of people. And I'm not kidding. We were talking about this top of the show out on the ice on the lake that what would be the water yesterday. There's like 1, 2, 3, like 7 or 8 people hanging out on the water. And the fire department is saying, don't do that.
Dr. Steve, the trauma surgeon, the SWAT guy, will tell you, you think you're a tough guy and stuff, but how, when I got thrown in the ice, all of a sudden my arms and legs decided that they were going to quit working today. And it just quit. It quit. So, yeah, you want to be a tough guy and you want to play games and tempt fate. You know, if you slide in there, you know, everyone thinks they could just crawl back. It isn't that easy. And if it's a first shock to you and you've never been there, you panic and you have that massive adrenaline release. And, oh, my God, it's over.
Yeah. 3 to 6 minutes, they say, for hypothermia, the CFD put out there.
Yeah, so, for sure.
Avoid it.
6 minutes is ridiculous. Yeah, 3 minutes. A minute and a half and no one's coming out unless you're highly trained and in shape.
Put it this way, I wouldn't want to be there. I would not want to be there. Thank you, Dr. Steve. Friday, we'll talk on vitamins, right? We'll get into that.
Yes, Friday, vitamins. We shall talk. Have a good week, everybody.
You too.